Welcome to the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, where you'll get actionable tips and advice on major gifts, direct response fundraising, legacy giving, and much more from leading experts in the nonprofit sector. Now, here are your hosts of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, Andrew Olson and Roy Jones.
Hey, everyone. Good afternoon. This is Andrew Olson with the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast. My co-host, Roy Jones, is unfortunately absent today. He's out doing the actual work of development, meeting with a donor right now, I believe in Nashville. So he's going to miss this great podcast episode. And I am thrilled because I've got my good friend and author of Engagement Fundraising, Greg Warner here. Greg, good afternoon.
What is up? Thanks for having me on.
Hey, man, I'm so excited about this. I think it's going to be a fun show for us to record and hopefully a fun and enlightening show for people to listen to. Just take a few minutes, please, and tell folks a little bit about yourself, what you do, introduce us to Market Smart. Go for it.
Well, I guess like most people in the sector, I didn't plan to end up being in this sector. But I guess, let's see, I'll try and be short about it. I mean, I'm kind of the, I'm a pissed off donor.
Okay.
Right? So I was running a marketing agency for the private sector, and we were focused on generating leads, highly qualified leads, and prioritized leads for salespeople. Of course, salespeople never think the leads are any good, and they want better leads so they close more sales. And that was a tough job, and I worked for a lot of CEOs, and we did it. We did it well. I found myself getting pelted and bombarded and confused by a lot of fundraising solicitations and plan giving newsletters and these kinds of things, and scratched my head and wonder what is going on here. So when I reached out to one of my favorite charities and pretty much said, hey, what are you trying to do with this? Especially because it was a newsletter about charitable gift annuities. And I was 37, I think, 38, I can't remember, 37, I think. So I really shouldn't be getting a letter or a newsletter on charitable gift annuities. And I said, what are you doing? And they're trying to generate leads, honestly, and for major gifts, which are charitable gift annuities and legacy gifts. And I said, well, is it working? And she said, no. And I was like, okay, so how many did you send out? It was something crazy, like 100,000.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was like, why are you doing? She's like, you have to understand, there's experts in the field that we hire that know all about this. And they've been doing it for decades. This is what they said to do. So we did it. And I go, okay, but now let me just connect the dots again. Did it work? No. So I'm like, okay. By the way, I'm a donor, so these are like my dollars you're throwing away. They're going into the circular, you know, can. So can I help you with that? Because sounds like you're trying to generate highly qualified leads for prioritization for salespeople. Oh, no, not for salespeople, she says. Fundraisers. I go, okay, I whatever you want to call them, that's fine. So we did it. We generated these leads and we prioritized them, immediately got referred to another diabetes organization and then another one, something for homeless kids and then a hospital. The big part was that in generating all these leads, I mean, sometimes thousands of them, it was hard to manage and prioritize people. So we started building technology to help prioritize. But then we also thought, you know, when you generate a lead for a highly considered decision, very much unlike the impulse decision that most fundraising is, it's very, you know, solicitous or sign up or it's just 1-2 punch. In the highly considered decision, and this is all, I'm getting deep into behavioral science, but it's a totally different thought process that the human being goes through, and it requires cultivation, and it requires content, information, education, involvement. So we built out an automated, I use the word AI, it's so broad, but it is, it's artificial intelligence that automates the cultivation process based on what people tell us in donor surveys and other forms of communication that elicit these leads and generate these leads. So was that the short story? I don't know. I'm counting 4 minutes right there. So
hey, it's shorter.
That's
than
how
some.
I got into this.
Awesome. And so recently, what was it, a year ago, you wrote the book Engagement Fundraising.
Yeah.
So congratulations on that. It's a great read. And for all the listeners, if you don't have a copy, get out to Amazon and grab it, please. Tell me two things about this. I'm curious to know why you decided to write the book.
Yeah.
And for what audience you're really speaking to in that book.
Yeah, perfect. So I wrote the book, I guess you could say, to plant the flag, because although I didn't really invent these marketing concepts, I mean, they've been around for 100 years. And even recently, this inbound marketing, or as some marketers call it, permission-based marketing, opt-in marketing, it has been around in the private sector for over 10 years now. But in the nonprofit sector, it's still a lot of push and outbound and what might be called interruption marketing. One way, you know, some will say it's two-way, you know, it's like, well, when they donate, that's two-way. Well, we're talking,
or when they complain.
I'm talking about a real dialogue here.
Right.
And I'm also talking about focusing on the 80-20 rule, which is now, according to my data, because I have an app called the Fundraising Report Card where we measure this. We've got over $43 billion in charitable donations we measure. And we built that app to take a look at the 80-20 rule. And it's really now, you're going to fall off your chair, but 70% of all charitable giving comes from 0.7%, that's less than 1% of people.
Wait a minute, say that again.
70% of all charitable giving from individuals comes from 0.7%, less than 1% of all the people.
That's staggering.
Well, hold on here. You want staggering? Let me turn it around the other way. Let's look at the low dollar donors. And this, by the way, is right on my report card. Just go to the benchmarks at fundraisingreportcard.com/benchmarks, right? It's right there. You can see what it is today. Okay. But generally, it's been hovering at, for the low dollar donors, like under $100 donors, mm-hmm. That makes up, I forget what percentage of the people. In fact, I'll pull it up. But it's something like 80% of the people, you know, 90% of the people, something crazy like that, right?
Yep.
The amount of the percentage, I should say, that delivers of revenue to the sector is 7% of the charitable sector's revenue.
Wow.
So it's not the 80-20 rule. You're not getting 80% of the revenue from 20% of the people. You're getting, 70% of the revenue from less than 1%, 0.7% of the people. And all the low dollar donors are making up just all that work is making up just 7% of all charitable giving from individuals.
That begs, I think, a huge question.
Yeah. And this, by the way, there's no way I can mess up this data. I mean, the charities are either synced with their CRM, because we have integrations with CRM, or they're uploading the data themselves. So I don't really have anything to do with manipulating it. I don't even touch the data. We programmed it to just analyze it.
Well, and I can attest to that. I actually used Fundraising Report Card for a number of my clients, and we use it regularly. And I would agree with you. I had never looked at that specific metric that you gave in the benchmark. But I see very similar trends in most of the files that we look at. So,
well, and one more startling, and I didn't really ever answer your question because we're going down a rabbit hole, which I knew we would do.
That's okay.
I forgot what your original question was. The other staggering number is the number of donors that just stop giving altogether.
Yes.
So we've been seeing, and I got to confirm this with other firms like Blackbaud and whatnot, but we've been seeing that about 5%, on average, 5% fewer people are giving at a time when the population in America keeps going up. So, and total revenue in America for the charitable sector, you know, giving keeps going up. So if giving is going up in total, but if it's not coming from low dollar donors, and frankly, we're losing donors Where the hell is it coming from? Well, it's pretty easy. It's coming from the top.
Yeah, I just saw the statistic, almost exactly those numbers, shared out yesterday. I think it was a Black Bond statistic as well. So I think those numbers track. You know, so this begs a question that you and I have grappled with on many occasions, and that I think I've shared with you. I fight with many organizations about this. Fight's not the right word. Maybe have impassioned discussions. But that is, if you're spending so much money on the tactics that really drive engagement with those low-dollar donors, right? So super high-volume direct mail, really transactional direct mail programs, special events that don't do anything to move the needle for actual relationship building. You know, how do you turn a ship that's as large as this sector is and is heavily invested in that? Also, when we don't have a culture of really allowing charities the time to test and iterate and fail occasionally, how do you square these things?
Well, it's funny because, you know, then you ask me, like, why'd you write the book? So, and that, which I didn't answer. How do I square it? I square it by trying to write a book.
Okay.
You know, me personally, I am pretty much, and unless somebody tells me somebody else is screaming this from the mountaintops and also building the technology to support it, which I have found that I'm really, I would love if there's others, but I wrote the book to plant the flag and say to people, number one, and this is my term from the book, fundraising climate change is happening, okay? It's, and not only is it happening, I mean, it's happening now. It's not coming. When I first started writing the book, I said, fundraising climate change is coming. You can't keep doing events and galas and raffles and 5Ks and massive amounts of mail and massive amounts of email and text messaging, interrupting people in one-way conversation or two-way, because it's an impulse-related, behavioral, scientific-oriented decision that you're asking them to make. What fundraising climate change is forcing is for the sector to not completely give all that up, but recognize that we really need to be aiming and treating the most wealthy and most passionate among humanity with a different kind of outreach, a different kind of communication system and philosophy, which is what I labeled engagement fundraising. At a high level, it's an understanding, and look, I've read all the books on behavioral science since I was like 12 years old and I decided I wanted to run an ad agency, you know? So when I was a kid,
this is a weird thing for a 12-year-old to want, but okay.
It is a weird thing. I got the book, the first book I ever bought is behind me, you know, on advertising. Weird thing? This is all I've ever studied. Am I great at math? No. But do I understand this? I understand this. I've studied everything from, you know, about brains and how human beings work. And the key, if you take anything away from my book, is that, and now you don't have to buy the book. Okay, well, go buy the book anyway. But the key is that there are really two basic ways that you can compel, inspire, motivate somebody to do something, which generally we want them to give money, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the first way is a impulse-oriented decision or a transactional decision. Those are generally really quick. We need help, give us money. Or you can be great if you give us money. Make it 25, 50, 100 bucks, 500 bucks, whatever you can, you know. You know, the traditional stuff.
Yep.
Right? And that's aimed at low dollar donors, unless you, and you tell me if any, this has ever worked, where you send an email out to a bunch of people and said, we need $4 million. Click here and put in your credit card. It doesn't happen. Right? So you want $4 million from somebody. You cannot just send them a letter. So this comes to the second type of behavioral process, you know, the psychology. It's not an impulse. It's not one way or transactional. It is engagement oriented and heavily value oriented in a way that recognizes that each human being and we're all the same, go through the same process and steps towards making a major decision. Now, if you're really scratching your head out there listening to this and you're saying, well, I don't understand, what are those steps that a multimillionaire goes through in order to which, by the way, is what, if we really want to raise that $4 million, you damn well need to understand not just wealthy people, but you need to understand their consideration process so you can mirror your marketing communications or whatever you want to call it, your outreach, your whatever you want to call it, fundraising, moves management, throw out the list of labels. You have to align each message with where that person resides in the consideration continuum. Meaning they can go forwards or backwards, and this can be a 6 month, a year, or a 5 year decision. And you have to understand first, do they recognize their need? Now, this is funny because people will say, well, is it about recognizing needs? Yeah, recognizing need stage. Yes, we have needs. Here's our case for support. Give us money.
But you're saying the donor's needs.
That's right.
Okay.
You've got to first recognize the donor's needs. That is the first step. And this gets a little bit self-promotional because, of course, on my platform, we invented the ultimate donor discovery system for identifying at scale, leveraging technology, what are the wealthy people's needs and where do they reside in the consideration process. So their needs can be that they want to gain notoriety. Their needs may be that they're interested in just reconnecting with old friends. Their needs are finding out how they can realize the best versions of themselves or live on after their own lifetime in the minds of others, especially their children. Or, I mean, there's any number of needs, but we need to understand their interests and how does their life story entwine with your mission? Do they love the ocean and want to care about sea life and endanger, you know, animals or whatever, because their father or grandfather taught them that? And if so, what was their grandfather's name? This is the first step. And I'm taking over your whole damn podcast. but I'm trying to tell you, there is a very long and very intricate consideration continuum whereby, and by the way, it all begins with trust. So if you don't have trust at the cornerstone in the foundation of your engagement fundraising process that aligns with their consideration continuum, you're out of luck. So you can't send them a letter asking them for $4 million. And also what you can't do that the leadership needs to understand is you can't just call them up and ask them for an appointment.
Well, that was going to be my question to you, because I think one of the things that I hear more than anything from development officers is, do you realize how tough it is to get a call back, to get a meeting? And I agree with them. I've done it myself. And it is really tough to get people at scale to respond to you. So what's the alternative?
Well, the alternative is to change your entire paradigm of thought in how you approach the donor, okay? And now remember, I'm the damn donor. I'm not giving millions of dollars, but I'd like to say, having been in business a while, I can afford to give a little bit more than a few dollars. And I've had practice being on the other end of the coin or the other side, meeting with some of these fundraisers and getting the calls and seeing exactly what they do. And I can tell you what they do wrong. usually I don't want a friggin' update and I don't want to give them anything yet.
You don't want to give them cash or anything at all?
I don't want to give them my time.
Okay.
Which is exponentially more value to be me and all the donors they reach out to than my cash, by the way.
I would agree. Yep.
And think about it. If you're worth $50 million, you got cash.
Right.
You're 74 years old. You're $50 million. Time is your valuable asset. And you're calling them and you're asking to take it by the very fact that you're calling them. So when I say change the paradigm of thought of what are you doing, you have to immediately recognize, and look, I do a whole training session on this. People who contact me, I qualify to see if you're qualified for my training. But if you email at info@imarketsmart.com, I do the whole hour-long training. It's free. I give it away for free. Okay. Now, but here's a snippet of it, is especially in the first outreach, you cannot ask or seem to ask for anything. You cannot use the word I, me, you know, we, us. Everything has to be about them and how you are calling and reaching out, aiming to provide value to them in some way that they will appreciate. Now, if you do the donor discovery, again, I'm sorry, it sounds like I'm selling my product. You could do your own darn, you know, survey or something by yourself without us, better with us. But, you know, if you are armed with a survey response, or you could call it a donor discovery report, where the supporter leaned in and told you that, you know, I care, this is why I care. Because there was this nurse named Jim who took care of my mother when she was ill. I'll never forget what they did for my mom and my family, right? And that happens.
Yeah.
People pour their hearts out. So, okay, just that one tidbit of information. So then if when you call, which by the way, better be really recently after the survey comes in, because our study shows that you can increase the likelihood that you land a meeting exponentially by hundreds of percent. If you reach out immediately and you say, wow, heartfelt, you say, hey, this is, you know, Miss Fundraiser and I'm calling, you wouldn't say Miss Fundraiser, you know, you say, I'm calling because we just received your survey and we didn't realize that you were helped in that way and that you felt this way about the hospital. And we wanted to let you know that there's actually some new things going on that are really fascinating. And I forget the name of the person I mentioned, maybe Jim. I said Jim was the nurse and Jim is actually spearheading it. And I wonder if you just might want to come down and take a look. So now, you're not really asking. I mean, you're asking, but you're giving.
Right. Well, and this is something that I've been talking about a lot lately. Of one of the big problems with the transactional fundraising model is it's all about extracting value from the donor without really ever giving any value back. So it's this kind of engagement that lets you do that, right?
Exactly. The outreach call, look, and by the way, some people have called me because they've heard me talk about this and they're like, well, look, Greg, a lot of times we call, we say like, hey, I'm calling from the university, and people are so happy to chat and they're happy to just have an appointment with us, you know? And I go, that's fine. I'm not saying don't set an appointment if people want to have an appointment or a meeting or if they want to give. That's cool. Go with it. But you got to start with a paradigm shift, with the mindset that you're not calling immediately to satisfy your leadership's needs, your needs, your board's needs. You're calling to satisfy your supporters' needs. And the more that you know what they are, the better chance, and the more recently they told you about them, the better chance you have of coming up with some kind of value that you can offer to them that will be relevant and they will really appreciate. And if it doesn't lead to an appointment on the first time, then there's always the second call where you can start off by offering them value again. This is a basic law of humanity, by the way, that works in every country and all around the world. It's called the law of reciprocity. It is basic, you know, give to people. Give more than they expect. Give more than you know, give. And if you do that they'll be more likely to give to you. And this is where I say in the book, I call it self-solicitation, where some people say, well, you got to ask for the gift. I'm like, I don't know, man. I've been in sales a long time and maybe fundraising is different, but everybody who's smart tells me it's exactly the same, is that if you do everything right and you give to that supporter and you give them opportunities for engagement and opportunities to feel good and opportunities to live on after their life, whatever it is, they end up self-soliciting and they'll come to you sometimes and just say, what can I do?
Yeah.
I see the need. You gave me this, you gave me that, you took me on the tour. I see, what do you want me to do? I'm here. And then it becomes them soliciting themselves. And by the way, this has all been proven in a neat little book, which is actually what I started reading in like 1987. And I always keep it on my desk. Fundraisers might get scared of it because it's called Spin Selling. It's a terrible name.
I wish everyone could see the picture, the image of this right now.
Right? It looks so cheesy. But this guy he followed 35,000 sales visits to figure out what the hell works.
Huh. Okay. Well, that's a decent enough sample size for me to think that it's legit there.
Ian. In the 80s, he did it. And he figured it out. It's all about, and I'll boil down the book. There's a lot more to it. It's all about having a giving mindset. So you ask the question, like, so what do they do? How do you change the paradigm? It's just if leadership can just take the pressure off a little bit and allow the fertilizer, you know, the seedlings, the water to cultivate, allow it to actually happen the way we talk about it in the books and at the conferences, and give to these people in relation to the ways that they've told you will make them feel good, then they will begin to move themselves forward in the consideration process as they bat away all the other charities that are pummeling them with solicitations or just asking them for appointments or money.
So often, one of the things that I hear is, oh, well, you know, changing that paradigm and doing this differently would take so long. We don't have the time or the money to wait. So tell me about your experience with your clients. Like, if they start a process like this and they change the way they're behaving, what is that gap in timeline between when that process starts on average and when they start to see fruit from it?
Sometimes it's unbelievably fast. Okay. So I'm going to tell you, there's an organization that, and I won't name them, but you know them. There are many people, most people who engage with an outreach, like a survey or something, most are not ready, right? So they need cultivation. There are going to be very few. This is not a pyramid, by the way. Turn the pyramid upside down. It's a funnel. There will be very few at the bottom of the funnel who are ready to take action. But if you engage with these people further and you offer them value, you know, a certain percentage are going to be ready because they were ready before. You know what I mean? It just happens that they got your survey, they filled it out, you called them in a timely way, you offered them value, meaning you built trust quickly. They liked you. The law of reciprocity went to an effect. They asked you to come visit them for coffee, and they gave you a $25,000 check. Why? Because she's worth $4 billion, and to give you a $25,000 check is the equivalent of you buying her coffee.
Fair enough.
Just no offense. You know, I don't know. It doesn't matter. It makes her feel good, and you did everything right. So that can happen in a week. Will it for everybody? No, it's not going to happen that fast because most people are going to be higher up in the funnel, in the consideration continuum, and they're not going to be ready, and they're going to need cultivation. They're going to want to build trust because they don't trust anybody at this point. So can it work? Here's another example. So I got a good friend, happens to be a big time muckety muck lawyer here in DC because he's old like me, right? I'm only 50, but right. So, and one of his clients happens to be one of the big, humongous social media companies. I don't want to give away who it is, but he's a big time muckety muck attorney. right? And he went to a certain college, and he loves them, and he also is on the board for an aquarium on an island.
Okay.
Okay. So he takes me out for coffee, and he says, "What should we do? We got to refurbish this aquarium. We're thinking about putting a box out front, you know, and asking for donations."
Okay.
Right? This is a big time lawyer. He's not a businessman. Big time lawyer.
Okay.
And I won't say his real name. Let's call him Steve. I said, "Steve, it's going to take you 223,000 years to refurbish this aquarium if you put a plastic box. Are you kidding me? And you live on an island with some of the richest, most wonderful, you know? And in fact, we're drinking coffee, and the restaurant next door in D.C. literally was owned by a friend of his who also has a house on the same island up in the Northeast."
Okay.
Right? So he's got these connections. So I go, "At your next board meeting, I'm going to help you write this survey, and you're going to just put it into the little packet that you guys always put. There's always a big packet. And then you all break and you get soda and, you know, you talk. Well, tell them at the next break to fill out this survey. Anonymous. I mean, it's just going to go to you. And if they don't want to fill it out, tell them you don't have to fill it out." Right? So people fill it out. And it's got questions. Why you care? And this and that, right? And where are you in the consideration process? Have you left us in our will? Have you considered giving? Of course, they ask them every year. They ask them for their gift, you know? And some of them, they're on the tickler file for the moves management and when they're going to ask them for the gift and all that stuff. And they do a dual ask, he told me, you know, and this whole thing, right? So he gets back the surveys and he calls me. And he's like, this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen in my entire life. He's like, "The things I just found out about all these people that I've been on this board with, some of them for years, and why they care, and what's motivating them, and what their interests are, and the amounts of money that a couple of them divulged that they left in their estate plans. I hadn't thought about this one. She doesn't even have any kids. I didn't think about it." So, like, you know, we could get this aquarium built when she dies. But I'm not going to kill her, you know? You can't kill her. She's nice. So do you understand what I'm saying? Uh-huh. So now they understand where they are. And I was like, "Well, so what do you find? Can you fund the thing just off of that?" And I'm answering your question, by the way, in case the listeners forgot. You asked me, how can you do this? Can you turn it around? Turn it around? You could turn it around in a minute. You can turn it around. It might be hard, though. You got to know what questions to ask. You got to understand the behavioral science. You got to understand the psychology. You could screw this up really bad. A survey is just a tool. Don't do it wrong. You know?
Yeah.
Most people use surveys because they want opinions. "How often should we reach out to you?" What? Come on. This is a qualification tool for major gifts and planned gifts and mid-level migration.
Yeah.
This is the key. So I don't know. Have you talked at all on this podcast? I don't know.
I think I said three words. Good stuff. I wanna switch topics real quick. We have just a few minutes left. You did an experiment. I don't know, maybe it was 3 or 4 months ago. I think I remember you mentioning this, that you actually, for some organization, made a bunch of donor calls.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. Why'd you do it? What did you learn?
Yeah, well, look, everything starts with me getting pissed off, right? So I
must be happy at your house some days.
No, you know, I'm really friendly, kind of pissed off guy, or it's just a general state of being. My wife says you can take the New Jersey out of the boy, but you can't, or you can take the boy out of New Jersey, but you can't take the New Jersey out of the boy. So maybe that's a little bit of it. So look, I this customer, I love them. I use them. Like they are a charity that actually provides services that is something that I need, right? Okay. And I use them, literally, right? So I give them money. But I also decided, you know, I'm going to give you my system. I said, but you got to use the system. Because, again, the system is designed to generate the most. This isn't prospect identification. I'm not talking about, identifying people who have wealth.
Right. This isn't a wealth screening tool.
No, this isn't a wealth screening. This is beyond wealth screening. Wealth screening will tell you some stuff. And then, like, according to one research study from Ruffalo, Noah Levitz said 37% of the people that go in your caseload from that are qualified. So that leaves, you know, do the math, 63% that are unqualified. That's not fun for a major gift officer who wants to have meetings.
Nope.
Right? So I'm not knocking that. Wealth screening, prospect identification, it's all necessary. We just don't do that. There's plenty of people who do. What we do is we do prospect qualification, prioritization for outreach, and cultivation for those that are not ready for outreach. And we signal to the fundraiser when they're ready for outreach. Okay. So when I gave them the system, I said, but you got to use the system. When we generate these leads, you got to use them. You got to call the donors. They are taking their time to engage with you and pour their hearts out to you. You've got a system that's prioritizing them and teeing them up based on how wealthy they are. Self-reported, by the way. So it's accurate. Mm-hmm. And where they are in the consideration process. Like, I'm thinking about giving you my house. You know, and it's, by the way, it's worth $2.3 million. Okay. So it's all there. And he wasn't calling them. So the
donors were self-qualifying.
Yeah.
He was getting that information, but then he wasn't following up.
Yeah.
Okay.
And now this is over 2.5 years. We got five. In fact, they were raising money because people were just finally, because of the automated emails.
Sure.
They're just coming to them, or they're just giving, you know. Now, but you're not going to get, you can't use artificial intelligence for everything.
Right.
Right. I mean, unless you want to quit, if every fundraiser listening to this wants to quit their job, all right, we'll replace. But the biggest dollars and the best revenue comes from face-to-face interaction, personal human interaction.
Absolutely.
That will never, ever, ever go away. And so you're guaranteed a job as long as you'll look at the leads, click the button to prioritize them and call them, right? So he wasn't doing it. I'm glad I didn't name the organization, but he wasn't doing it. And I care about the organization. Of course, he tells me he's too busy, this, that, the other thing. Truth is, he didn't really like outreach, you know, and calling. He didn't like talking to donors. He liked operations stuff.
Okay.
He wanted to sit in the meetings and talk about the next computer system they're buying or the next program and initiative. He liked funding things with the money. He didn't, you know, and I'm not trying to disparage him. It just wasn't his thing.
Sure.
But also, he would hire a person to do it. So I said, look, I'm gonna call him. I'll call him for you. And I'm going to set meetings for you. You've got to finally, if they are begging to talk to you, will you talk to him? Yes. Right. So that's where that came from. And we recorded, my staff looked at it and was like, well, let's record these calls. And we did it mostly for him so that he could hear the calls for his donors. So he knew what was said before he talked to them when the meetings were set. But also what they did was really cool was they dissected how much, and it's funny I'm saying this, how much did I talk during those calls compared to how much I listened. Now, this is funny because I'm talking all the time today, right? But I'm telling you, I know what I'm doing. I've been in sales a long time. On those calls, it's not a podcast. These are donor engagement calls. I listened.
Yeah.
So what they broke it down mathematically. They showed me 75% of the time I was listening and 25% of the time, which I even still think is too much, but I was talking.
Okay.
Is that the experiment you were talking about?
Because I just that is the experiment. No, it's totally different one. Yeah, no. That's the one I was talking about. So what's happened since?
What, with that particular guy?
Yeah. Have they made any progress?
No. So
that's unfortunate.
I gotta wear my heart on my sleeve. Like, I can't tell a lie. He didn't really feel comfortable even calling these people. So he did a couple. And then there were some that like really needed calls, really wanted calls, and even just needed like thank you calls because they're big donors.
Yep.
And I had wonderful, engaging conversations with them. And then I would follow up with them and say, just make sure you called X, Y, and Z. Oh, yeah, I hadn't gotten to that yet. So I threw up my hands and I just said, okay, I'm not going to do his job for him. I got a company to run here. But he just wasn't interested. So I don't know what the takeaway is from this. It breaks my heart because I like the organization. But, you know, they're teed up there, and some of these people were multimillionaires. And I looked at their bios and everything. You know, some of these people were inventors of amazing. If I told you some of the companies that they run and stuff, you'd know them.
Huh. Yeah.
But he just wasn't interested. Just wanted the money to come in anyway.
Yep.
And what I'm trying to tell you, and this brings it back around to the fundraising, engagement fundraising in the book, is that fundraising climate change is coming whether people want to recognize it or not. I've got the data and so many others are pointing it out. The one-way transactional impulse-oriented marketing is good, but it's good for bringing in donors so that we can move them, or frankly, I like prefer to say, help them move themselves into the major and mid-level, major, and plan giving realm. And I think every agency, and you and I have talked about this, and every fundraiser should be looking at the first donation as the beginning of a massive potential relationship. But you have to understand that there's a switch. So at one point, you may be doing the 1-2 transactional, and the behavioral science that goes along with that is very different. You have to turn a corner and switch to using the type of behavioral science that is more measured, engagement-oriented, value-oriented, patient, and all about where the donor resides in the consideration process, and then aligning your offers, value, presentations, communications with where they reside in the communications process. You do that, they will either self-solicit or you will know darn well when they're ready for the solicitation, rather than relying on some wealth screening thing telling you that you should call this donor and ask them for $50,000 today. Because that ain't gonna work.
Nope, no it's not. Well, that was good stuff, man. We covered a whole lot of ground. But
we? I think it was me. No, I love you, bro.
I kept the recording going. How about that, man?
Let me go.
No, that was really good stuff, and I think really actionable, you know, recommendations. It's not rocket science. It's specific, and there are things you have to do and get right to make it work. But it's not like somebody has to completely upend the system, you know, and what they're doing to make this work. They just got to do a few really important things differently, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, here's the last point I'll leave you with then, because I have the data. And anybody who wants to contact me, I'll show them the data, okay? I'm not going to publish it and all that. I don't have time, you know? But millions of people here in America, and we have clients in other countries, Canada, Australia, Israel, millions of people around the world have massive amounts of wealth, and they are very interested in giving it away. What's preventing them from giving it away is friction that starts with a basic lack of trust caused by poor outreach that doesn't treat them fairly based on, I hate to sound like a broken record, based on where they are in the consideration process and a recognition that you need to communicate with them at that level and at that stage. Is it harder to do it this way? Is it, I'm talking about behavioral science and breaking down all this. Is it harder? Yes. Are you focusing on fewer people and saving a lot of money on all that communications? Yes. Are the dollars astoundingly, exponentially greater? Oh, yes. The fundraising sector's problem is not that there are not enough donors, and especially not enough wealthy donors. Its problem is that it's not understanding how to communicate people and how to turn the switch to communicate with them in a different way, like what I call engagement fundraising, so that it serves their needs, the donors' needs first, and then serves the needs of the organization. That's the win-win.
Boom. We're going to leave that right there. That's good stuff, man. Hey, if people want to get in touch with you, what's the easiest way?
Well, they can contact me at info@imarketsmart.com. Check me out on LinkedIn, Greg Warner, GREGWARNER. Somehow amassed 10,000 followers. I get like 10 or 20 a day. And I actually engage with people. If you ask me questions, I will try to help you. I'm a real person.
And I will say, yeah. For folks that don't believe, that's true, because Greg and I first connected over social media. So, you know, that's how our relationship came to be. So I would totally attest to that.
Yeah, I love it. I stay up all night chatting with people. Some of them are, you know, I had a little old lady who tells me she rides her bike in the Netherlands and listens to my podcast. So I'm like, she's reaching out to me. I don't know. All right. So, the last thing is check out my website at imarketsmart.com. Tons of free resources there. Tons.
Awesome. Hey, man, thanks for being here today. Thanks for sharing your wisdom with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, bro.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, brought to you exclusively by Newport One. Newport One can make a difference in your fundraising so that you can change the world. You can always reach us at podcast@newportone.com. Please take a moment to rate this episode on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. When you rate this episode, it will help more nonprofit leaders just like you to help find us and get the information that they need to raise more funds for their organization. Thanks again for listening today.